now approaching. Junction at platform. Passengers, airport, please stay on board. Next stop, road station.
iOS helps you control which apps you share your exact location with. There's more to iPhone.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello and welcome to the Game Football Podcast from The Times. Today, we're taking inspiration from Jim Ratcliffe, and so I am proud to announce that we will be named the greatest podcast in the world within 3 years. I'm only joking. But we will be discussing Ratcliffe and his plans for Manchester United. We'll also be talking about the Carabao Cup final and the midweek action as Arsenal concede a late sucker punch against Porto. And joining me, Tom Clark, for all of that, we have the chief correspondent for The Times and Sunday Times, Martin Samuel, a football writer and the author of our Monday football newsletter, James Gearbrandt, and a former footballer who can sympathise with Arsenal players as he too knows about conceding late goals in the Cup. After his Northampton side were cruelly knocked out of the 2014 FA Cup by Rochdale, losing 2-1 in the 90th minute, having been leading 1-0 with 5 minutes to go. Gregor Robertson is here too. Still, Sting, you at fault for any of those two goals? 85 and 90 you conceded.
More worryingly, I don't remember that at all.
Honestly. Anyway, listeners are very, very keen for me to find out whether you, Martin Samuel, have a nickname. From Monday's show, we were talking about nicknames and titles. And I ended the show by saying whether I'd have the cheek to give you my own nickname. Ever had a nickname within journalism?
I think Dicko calls me. No, it's not a nickname, is it? I mean, Dicko calls me Sam. A few people call me Sam.
Called Sam
but that's not really...
Well, maybe because of your squeaky water bottle, which makes an intro from time to time. I was thinking maybe I could call you WD-40.
Yeah. Just the once you can.
Yeah. Okay, fine. that went a lot better than I was expecting, listeners. Right, to the action. And there's lots to discuss, so we're going to go quick fire through the midweek stuff. Arsenal completely sucker punched by Porto, but I did think this was an interesting game in terms of what we maybe saw in Porto. And Gregor, it looked like they'd been reading your articles about Arsenal's efforts at corners and their threat from corners, because they completely nullified that by just diving all over the place, didn't they?
Yeah, they definitely watched as many of Arsenal's corners as I did for that piece.
Three?
All of them, Tom, as you know. My Y-Scout account nearly kicked me out with overuse. Yeah, that was the kind of key theme for us. Some people are calling them naive after this, but I think there's just a different feel about European ties sometimes, and even the way they're officiated. And when you watched the way that, as you say, Porto's players, defenders were either grappling, which meant that the referee had to kind of blow his whistle and halt the corner and intervene and have a word with people initially and say, less grappling, please. And then, or they were falling to the ground. It was just like creating, there was more likelihood for a foul to be given from the off.
Do you think it was, I thought it was interesting, even in the very first minute, I think, was it the first minute Declan Rice got booked, lost the ball?
Yeah, that was a bit unlucky.
Silly lunge, got nutmegged, and it was just that kind of thing of where maybe, Arsenal were going, oh God, Christ, as you say, we're in a Champions League game here, bloody hell, this is not the Premier League.
Yeah. Yeah, it just had a different feel, and the way that they bought fouls, the way that they grappled, but without being penalised for it, it just felt different. You know, it feels like Arsenal can get away with these things, and often the way that they protected the goalkeeper, even from the set pieces, was completely different to anything you've seen in the Premier League. It was kind of militant, and it worked because from the very first corner as well, the keeper came and claimed it, and a lot of the times he did. And this is only one part of the game, but it was Arsenal's biggest threat. They didn't create anything from open play.
Yeah.
And very often this season, that's what's opened the game up for them. They've managed to get ahead of the set piece, and it didn't work.
James, what have you made of Arsenal in recent weeks? We've not had you on the show for a while. Obviously, they've kind of went through a difficult period, then had that win against Liverpool, and are now blowing everyone away. Now another little dip in this defeat. What are you making of Mikel Arteta's side this season?
I mean, overall, I think Arsenal are a really, really good team. I think
improved on last year?
I think so, yeah, a little bit. I think they are probably a little another step ahead of where they were last season. As you say, I mean, they had a couple of, you know, poor results. I think one really poor performance, which was the game against Fulham. But you could say that of all the main contenders, they've all had their slip-ups. And I think, in my opinion, I think defensively, they're the best team in the Premier League. I mean, to see the way that they nullified Liverpool, and also the way they nullified Liverpool and City in their home games, really restricting two really good attacks to very, very little indeed. I think, you know, their level of control in those games was really impressive. On the Porto game, I kind of go along with what Gregor says, and I think it was one of those games, and I think we had all these debates a few seasons ago. If you remember the Liverpool v Atletico Madrid game, it's similar, you know, lots of the sort of, you know, kind of grappling. It was kind of bitty, broken up, you know, very arrhythmic and
shithousery. I'll say it because
you know, a bit of shithousery, yeah, of course. But I actually kind of like that. I think in a world where it feels like the things which made European football different are sort of, you know, I think there are less and less of those things, you know, even like things like away goals we don't have anymore. And I think we're probably moving towards a, you know, a football landscape where the Champions League and the Premier League look more and more similar. And I think it's actually in my opinion, I think it's actually a good thing to have elements which just feel completely unlike the Premier League and make the Champions League feel like actually a completely distinct challenge. Almost like, you know, when you have games like this where the ball in play time is so low and you have so many fouls, it almost feels like it's kind of a slightly different sport or a slightly different version of the same sport. And I quite... Although obviously it's not fun to play against, it's something
that's
not even
a great spectacle. It's not even
particularly fun to watch. But I kind of, maybe you wish it away at your peril, because I think it's one of the things that makes the Champions League feel like a real distinct challenge, even for teams which are really, really strong domestically.
There were 36 fouls, 22 of them by Arsenal, which is the highest number of any game in the Champions League this season. And the ball was in play for 52% of the game.
Yeah, but isn't it interesting that James is making that point? And, you know, we've almost come full circle from maybe the days where we would have sat down and watched the Champions League to see the best passing and technical abilities and, you know, skill on show. And we were coming back to maybe the English game for a bit of the nitty-gritty and some of that S-housery. Martin, what do you make of James's kind of analysis about the game more broadly and that kind of contrast between Premier League and Europe?
I've never minded it, even Atletico Madrid, I think it was a game, I think it was against Manchester City, when it was just so extreme by the end of it. It just looked at it and thought, no, this is wrong. But mostly, you know, you've got, you know, I never minded long ball. I never minded what Wimbledon did and or anything like that, going all the way back to those sort of crazy gang days. You just thought, right, you've got to beat it. You've got to find a way of beating it. When Arsenal couldn't get ahead of Stoke in successive matches because they, successive meetings, because they couldn't handle the sort of the throw-ins and they couldn't handle the way Stoke played, I didn't have a huge, as long as you're not kicking people up in the air, as long as you're not, you know, putting people out of the game for 6 months, you've got to find a way around it. You've got to find a way of beating it. But I don't read too much into what happened last night. If they were to get knocked out, which I don't think they will, if they were, you'd look at it and go, they've gone out in the last 16 again. I think this is a run of seven to here, that they've gone out in the last 16 of the Champions League and they haven't been in the tournament for some of that period as well. It's a long, long record of not being able to get out of the last 16. And if that happened again, you'd look at it and think, well, you probably need a different mindset to get you through the knockout stage of this tournament, because something's clearly wrong. But I think they will beat Porto. I think they're a better team than Porto. And I do think that we will be looking at it very, very differently if the guy doesn't hit a goal out of the screws in injury time, which, you know, poor clearance stroke pass by Martinelli to give them the ball back at that stage. But the goal itself, the shot itself, he's not going to hit that every single week, as I think as was proven by the missed chance early in the game. So I think Arsenal get through.
There you and are, then, Arsenal fans.
No, it means nothing. I mean, means absolutely nothing. I think they'll get through. I mean,
it does. It does. WD-40's giving you the backing. See, got it in a second time there.
He's not thrown a coffee
over me yet, listeners. But moving on, Arsenal's title rivals, Liverpool and Manchester City, both picking up wins in their midweek games. Don't want to dwell too much on the action. I just want to ask Martin and James their current view on the title race, because we discussed it on Monday with Alisson and Gregor. How are you looking at it with these three teams now? Because it does feel like it's slightly settled into the idea of a three-horse title race. James, who are you looking at? I am going to come and ask you who's going to win the Premier League title, by the way. So, you know, allow this to be your considered build-up.
I think it's, you know, developing into a really good title race.
Don't see Manchester City running away with it, or do?
I don't see Manchester City running away with it, but I still think they're the most likely winners. But I don't necessarily... It's always hard to remember exactly how you felt at this time last season, but I think I don't have quite that same sense of kind of gathering force that you sort of usually get from City at this time in the season. Having said that, I think they've won something like 7 out of their last 8, haven't they? So it's still a pretty good run. In recent weeks, I've been really, really impressed by Arsenal. Obviously have to, slightly discount the Champions League performance last night. But I think Arsenal, as I say, they look really, really solid. I mean, it is often the case that, it's a truism that, often title wins are built on great defences. And I do think Arsenal probably are the best defence in the Premier League at the moment.
Do you agree with that? Former Defenders Union, would you agree with James's?
Yeah, I think all the kind of underlying numbers support that entirely as well.
Why do you think that is, James? Is it the players, or is it the back four? You're saying the best defence, but a defence is more than that. Is it the way the team plays?
I think it's obviously both those things. I mean, I think.
Race.
It helps that they just that central trio of Saliba, Gabriel, Rice. Although having said that, I've actually also really liked it when Jorginho has played the slightly deeper role, and I think that also is a really nice balance. But
there were moments last night too when Rice kind of galloping, typical Rice movements, basically where he was galloping back, covering whether it's a fullback or a through ball that he was tracking the runner. He was like, he's tireless. He does those things so well, and that's like, that reduces the number of opportunities that the other team can build. Really,
I think
as well. Sorry, one other thing that Arsenal, you can almost divide Arsenal's season into kind of from December onwards and before that, and they're actually, their attack has been transformed in that time as well. I think there was all the conversation about how much they needed a striker. It kind of began to dwindle, obviously, last night, again, aside. And even the underlying numbers for how many chances they're creating and the quality of the chances they're creating have been transformed as well. Odegaard's dropped a little bit deeper. It's kind of changed the balance a little bit with Havertz. Because that was something that was difficult to start in the first opening kind of few weeks of the season. It was like, you realised that Xhaka was quite valuable. And Havertz wasn't really filling that role, and if he was playing up front, he wasn't filling that role. So I agree, I think at both ends Arsenal are looking really good. I still think they need a striker, but it's whether they can continue to have the same sort of solid defensive base and discount those fears, those ideas about them needing a striker and scoring enough goals. They're in the race though,
I think. So just really quickly, I think defensively it comes down to two things. I think one of the things is that they're just very well coached. All the off-ball movements, all the pressing, I think is just very well coached. But the other thing I think is just that continuity of selection. I think I've said before, I think Arteta in many ways is a very old school manager. I see quite a lot of I've written about it before. I see quite a lot of Fergusonian traits in Arteta, and just that back four with a slightly less so on the left back position, but White, Saliba, Gabriel. It's just such a kind of well-grooved unit. They play together so many times, and I think they benefit, just from those relationships being so well-grooved as well.
Martin, how are you seeing the title race evolving? at the moment?
There's three teams in it.
Thanks very much. Moving on. Nothing else to add?
No.
Is this because I called you WD-40 for a second time?
No, it's not at all. You're a monkey. it's just because it's three teams in it. That's what it is. Where are we? February.
Do you see City running away with it? Same question I asked James.
No, I don't see City running away with it at all.
What do you make of Jurgen Klopp's comments after the win against Luton, talking about this kind of thing that we've slightly built towards over having injuries and things? Alisson's made the point before on Monday's show where you kind of know, you're kind of slightly chaotic, we'll score more than you a little bit, slightly haphazard. He's just said, we'll get 11 players on the pitch, we'll give it a go, talking about the Carabao Cup final, of course. Do you think that might run out at some point, that kind of, you know, momentum, if you like?
No, not necessarily. They've done it before. I mean, possibly their greatest result under Jurgen Klopp. If you think of the title-winning season as a group of results, the greatest individual night is 4-0 over Barcelona, and that's half a team.
Mm.
He does that with half a team.
Yeah, very true.
So he has got there's a spirit at Liverpool that he has built, that he has created with the recruitment department. They've bought very, very well, but they've bought character as well. And he is very good at getting character from his team. And character will get you a reasonable part of the way. And having 11 better players than Luton will get you the 4-1 against Luton. That's you know, if you look at one team there, if you look at a team sheet there and a team sheet there, and there's no one from that right side that will get in the left side's team, you know, the team on the left is probably going to win.
It does say something, though, that he was even like willing to draw a parallel with the Barcelona result after beating Luton Town at home.
Yeah.
Like, and that's not to say anything negative about Luton, who've been greatly improved, but that does show that there was like a bit of desperation about this as they were entering the second half.
Do you think that'll carry into this weekend's Carabao Cup final then? Playing against the Chelsea team, who don't necessarily know what you're going to get, but are on a little bit of a mini run by Chelsea standards?
It's funny, you never see a cup final played with that sort of abandon, do you?
No.
Cup finals are notoriously edgy, Liverpool, and sort of cagey. And
Chelsea-Liverpool last year, was it two goalless draws? Mm. Or one goalless draw, wasn't it? And
you don't think, even with how Liverpool are playing this season?
I mean, it'd be remarkable if it did. And
Chelsea's Pochettino's team have stepped up a little bit in bigger games against bigger teams, and kind of the Manchester City result, 4-4 obviously, is one I'm thinking of.
Yeah, I just can't see it. I think, as I say, for the same reasons, cup finals are always that way. It's very rare that two teams come out kind of gung ho and try and attack each other from the off. I mean, I kind of hope they do, but I think both will try and kind of feel their way in. And I still think Liverpool are probably favourites, though.
Yeah, Chelsea. The problem with Chelsea is they can't keep needing so many chances to score. You know, cup finals are notoriously cagey. You're not going to get too many chances. So Nicholas Jackson, I think, has missed, I think the figures 14. Were 14 or 15, what they would call big chances, scoreable chances, this season. Well, you can't do that in a cup final because you're not going to get that many. So when you get one, you've really got to take it. Particularly when you're playing a team as good as Liverpool. So that's Chelsea's problem. But Chelsea against Manchester City the other night, I thought were fantastic.
Yeah,
I really did.
James, how do you see it going?
Yeah, similar to Martin, I was really impressed by Chelsea against Manchester City. I just feel like it's very kind of, I think their season has been very, you know, two steps forward, one steps back. But I do think that we are beginning to see that, you know, kind of best 11. Crystallised a little bit more. I thought De Zassi played really well against Man City. But obviously I think Liverpool are favourites. You know, they have an awful lot of experience of cup finals under Jurgen Klopp, and I think that counts for a lot as well. I think Liverpool are favourites.
Nil-nils all round going to penalties then, lads, is what you're saying. I'm back in a 4-3 win for Chelsea. That's looking ahead to the weekend. I wanted to come back to another piece of action that happened this week off the pitch. Thomas Tuchel announcing that he's going to leave Bayern Munich in the summer. Always goes well when a manager announces that he's going to leave in the summer before he...
He didn't announce it, did they? They announced it.
Well, they announced it, yes, sorry. No, quite right. But I wanted to look at what that might mean for the managerial merry-go-round and Xabi Alonso in particular, because, James, you were in Germany recently to watch Xabi Alonso's Bayer Leverkusen. Impressed?
Yeah, I mean, I think hard not to be impressed by Xabi Alonso's team this season, really. But so I went to watch the... game between Bayer Leverkusen and Bayern Munich, which obviously finished 3-0 to Bayer Leverkusen, and they really dominated the game as well. And I think it was a particularly kind of striking because it felt like Xabi Alonso really won the tactical battle, and you know, Thomas Tuchel in those kind of sort of one-off, you know, situations is no slouch. I mean, I think, you know, there have been, I think we can all remember many, many games, you know, both in the Premier League and obviously on that Champions League one, where it felt like Tuchel really, you know, got his tactics spot on and you know, slightly outmaneuvered, you know, even some really top coaches. But it felt like, Leverkusen just completely won the game from that point of view. Alonso named a slightly different team than he usually did, and it was sort of, you know, there was sort of that sense of, has he kind of tweaked a little bit too much here? But it was absolutely spot on. Bayern were really nullified, but in an interesting way, because Leverkusen played a very different game from usual. They were quite content to have 40% possession and just really rip them apart on the counter, and it really... it was obviously an extremely impressive performance, and obviously it does seem to have really kind of solidified Alonso's position as, you know, really the most promising coach in the game, and you know, very much a wanted commodity. It seems.
Martin, do you see the Alonso situation being fast-tracked, if you like, with either Liverpool or Bayern Munich, now that we know we've got these two massive clubs? As I say, it doesn't often end well, or doesn't often happen, where we know a manager's leaving but not till the end of the season. And as James says, Alonso is the poster boy of modern football management at the minute.
Well, number one, I can't understand what Bayern Munich have done, because if Thomas Tuchel was struggling at Bayern Munich before... now you've basically told all the players, well, you ain't got to worry about him beyond May. I don't really see how that's any good for their dressing room whatsoever. It's not like Jurgen Klopp leaving Liverpool, where I think they announced it because maybe they thought it was bound to come out, and they didn't want to be reactive. They wanted to be proactive, and they wanted to be fair with the fans and everything. And maybe if they were already putting things in place, making overtures to other managers and saying, look, at the end of the season, you know, and they might have just looked at that and thought, well, this is going to come out, so we need to get ahead of this. But as previously discussed, Klopp has built an enormously strong team there in terms of its character and its loyalty to him. Tuchel at Bayern Munich, probably not the same. It's always been quite a deal. I mean, the last 11 years when they've won the title, if you go back before, there was always murders with Bayern Munich. You know, when Germany fail at a tournament, you see how fractured the country actually is between the Bavarian papers and then the papers in the Ruhr region, and the, you know, everyone sniping at each other. It's the Bayern Munich players against the world and all of this. So it has the potential to rip itself apart, weasels in a sack. And you can see that happening between now and the end of the season, because Thomas Tuchel's a lame duck there now. That's problematic. And as far as the question I was actually asked, which was about can you see it being accelerated? Well, if someone's smart, it's got to be accelerated, doesn't it? I mean, all I keep reading is, oh, we're going to look at data. It's going to be data this and data that. And you go, well, put into your data what happens if Bayern Munich come in and offer him the job before you do. Because, you know, there's no data program for that one, for you getting gazumped.
So you think Liverpool should be in there now?
Without a shadow of a doubt. If he's the guy, then you've got to be in there now.
They need to make it clear that they want him.
Absolutely.
But it's also sensitive because, I think if he's got anything about him, he'll say, look, guys, I'm in the middle of achieving something quite historic here.
Yeah.
Let's talk about it in the summer. But just, yes, clearly, I'm sure both of them, Bayern as well, and maybe anyone else will be saying, listen, just to like let you know, we're very much interested. So when you're having the conversations, we'll be there too.
Thinking of you, hon.
Absolutely.
Kiss.
You don't have to do it with Alonso. One presumes that Alonso has got an agent, a lawyer, an accountant, or anyone else. You can say, okay, Xavi, thank you very much. We'll talk to your man, your people. And if you would tell him what you would like and stuff, we can make sure that you're left absolutely alone to concentrate on winning the league for Bayer Leverkusen. As soon as that's done, you fly to Liverpool and we'll do this deal. You can be too clever by half. You really can. I mean, he's a very, very obvious candidate. People forget, I suppose, that he was a Bayern Munich player as well.
Yeah.
So it's not just, oh, he could go back to Liverpool where he's well-loved. He could go back to Munich where he's well-loved, apart from the fact he's just nicked the title off him.
Yeah.
But it will then feel like a little bit of a win if you're Munich because you've won the last 11 titles and then the one time you didn't win it, you took the manager.
Mm.
So, you know, that's as near as you can get to a win anyway. You've stuffed Bayer Leverkusen and now you've got their manager.
Yeah, I'm sure it won't be the last time that we talk about the Xabi Alonso situation on the podcast this season. Now, this is the Thursday show. Of course, you might be listening on a Friday, but either way, on Friday, so tomorrow, we'll have a very special bonus episode for you. Alison, our superstar from Mondays, took producer Neil off to meet George Ellacobi ahead of Maidstone's televised fifth round tie at Coventry. They asked him which player gave him the hardest afternoon during his career. Have a listen to this.
Old Trafford, Luis Nani. The first time I played against him, there was a 10-minute spell right in front of the technical area. He tortured me.
Tortured you?
Yeah. That's when I knew there were levels. Yeah. I knew that was the first time coming up against a winger like him where everything he did in that 10-minute spell worked out his way. Even when I tried to intercept and I tried to nick a ball, hit him and went through my legs, and by the time I turned around I was screaming for my defenders to come across, but I was recovering with speed as well, and I subsequently had to tell him, had to show him what he didn't know. So what I did was I booted him. Yeah, so I gave him a good kick right, I'm going to name drop, right in front of Mr. Sir Alex Ferguson. And that sort of slowed him down a little bit. And then I regained my composure and my confidence. I knew I was a good one versus one defender. And I was never fearless of any winger. I respected them in how I prepared. So I knew I was ready. And then after that, I started having joys against him. So he was trying to step over us. And it was so difficult because he could shift either side. He was equally good on his left, good on his right. For a left fullback or a right fullback, it's difficult because you're playing against elites. If you show him and not get the angles right, he will hurt you.
Yeah.
And he did for a 10-minute spell. Absolutely tortured me. But that's a lesson. If anything, he gave me more firepower to want to do well against him throughout that game, which I stuck to the game plan. And then after that, I must have faced him about three more times. And to be honest, it was even Stevens.
Just because he booted him, apparently. I initially thought he said he butted him and thought he said he headbutted him, but no, he booted him. A classic tactic for a defender. Nani is one that fascinates me, just very quickly. quite underrated in my opinion, because he kind of slightly, because he wasn't Cristiano Ronaldo at Manchester United, but he was an incredible player in my opinion. Martin?
Yeah, he was.
He was all right.
I'm saying very underwhelmed by life generally at the moment. But yeah, he was all right. I mean, there was a fellow on the other wing that was one of the greatest footballers you'll ever see. So, Nani, yeah, okay. I'm thinking. Sorry?
Producer Neil has just been wanting to clarify on George's behalf that he'd say that you couldn't get away with that now, and he didn't kick him very hard. Just for full clarity. Now that he's a manager, I think.
That's
disappointing. Yeah, absolutely.
You've got a Football League fullback here going, what?
It's I'm him. Thinking about Manchester United wingers. Nani isn't... I don't think Nani makes the top five under Ferguson.
No, certainly. But they've had loads, haven't they? I'm just saying that I think
Giggs,
he kind of...
Kanchelskis... Cristiano Ronaldo.
Yeah.
I mean,
carry
they've
on.
Had some players.
Gabriel Obertón.
They've had some players. No, I mean, I'm going back to before.
You go on, come on. You've only named three.
Lee Sharp was better. Steve Coppell was better. Gordon Hill was better. you know, how many...
Dennis Irwin was better if you played him on the wing.
But they were all wingers. I mean, how far back do you want to go? I mean, you know, they were.
Honestly, thought I was going to get a bit of support for the Nani.
He had some great moments.
Remember the moments.
Remember he scored a great lob once, and he also did a fantastic backflip.
He did. Yeah, loads of great goals. More than the odd good goal. Anyway,
he was very good in our FIFA.
Yeah, there you go.
He was very good in our FIFA because he was invisible.
Is this the invisible Nani? Yeah.
We had an invisible Nani. He was absolutely fantastic. It was a glitch. It was a glitch in our FIFA game. And so Nani was invisible, and he only appeared when you put the little thing over the top, and he would so you could get him to turn up from frigging nowhere. I mean, it was absolutely magnificent. He was never as effective for Manchester United as he was in our FIFA game.
He was too visible at United.
Yeah, exactly.
He was too corporeal.
He needed to be more invisible. That's what you need, invisible wingers.
Yes, well, I'm sure. Well, maybe that's part of George Ellacobe's
tactics
for Maidstone's clash with Coventry. You can hear the full interview in a special episode, as I say, tomorrow. And if you've ever wondered how a coach gets to that level to get his team ready, George has got all the details. Anyway, back to today's show. And speaking of Nani and Manchester United, stick with us because we're talking about them and Jim Ratcliffe next.
I had a fella called David Beckham as well.
Oh,
just
there
realised
you go.
I forgot.
iOS helps you control which apps you share your exact location with. There's more to iPhone.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Welcome back to the Game Football Podcast from The Times. I'm Tom Clark, and today I'm joined by James Gearbrandt, Martin Samuel and Gregor Robertson. To Old Trafford then, and to Jim Ratcliffe, and these words. It's not a 10-year plan. The fans would run out of patience if it was 10 years. But it's certainly a 3-year plan to get back to the top. I think it's the club's 150-year anniversary in 2028. If our trajectory is leading to a very good place in that sort of time frame, then we'd be very happy. Because it's not easy to turn Manchester United into the world's best football team. We have a lot to learn from our noisy neighbour. And the other neighbour, that's Liverpool. The noisy neighbour, of course, is Manchester City. And they are the enemy at the end of the day. There is nothing I would like better than to knock both of them from their perch. he's done the full bingo kit, hasn't he, there, for taking over at Manchester United. References to Ferguson, references to City, noisy neighbours, Liverpool. It's punchy stuff, isn't it, Martin?
Yeah, it is. I mean, it's a club that can't escape Alex Ferguson, isn't it? Because that was Alex's comment about knocking Liverpool right off their effing perch, which he said to Michael Walker in an interview. And 3 years isn't very long at all.
It's not.
3 years isn't very long at all. If you think how long it took Jurgen Klopp to win his first Premier League, so far his only Premier League title with Liverpool, it was a lot more than 3 years. If you look at how long it took Manchester City, with all of Abu Dhabi's money, to win their first Premier League title, it was more than 3 years. Blackburn Rovers and Jack Walker, that's more than 3 years, I think, as well. Admittedly, they start in the wrong division. But it's that, you know, things can change remarkably quickly in football. People, you know, oh, it's going to take forever. It's not going to take forever. If you're an elite football club with a lot of money to spend, you can turn it around very quickly. Arteta, Arsenal, went from nowhere to coming very, very close to winning the league in no time at all. However, there is quite a lot wrong at Manchester United, and one of the things they keep talking about is the limitations of financial fair play, because obviously we've got a set of rules here where we've got to pretend Manchester United have got no money. So while we're pretending Manchester United have got no money, it's going to be difficult, because we've all seen Anthony. And, he doesn't look like a title-winning player. There's a lot of guys there that don't look as if you're going to win a title with them. So there's a lot of rebuilding that needs to be done. And it's, you know, the one thing that could happen. Klopp is leaving Liverpool, so that's big. Manchester City, we still don't know what the outcome of the 115 charges are. So those two teams that he's talking about, they are not... You might not have to knock Manchester City off their perch. A group of lawyers might knock Manchester City off their perch. So Manchester United might not need to lift a glove against Manchester City. Liverpool could be knocked off their perch by the fact that the new guy isn't Jurgen Klopp, even if he is Xabi Alonso and he looks a very promising manager. That could happen as well. So then suddenly Manchester United are taking on who?
Arsenal.
Tottenham, Aston Villa, maybe Newcastle. That's a completely different proposition.
Very true, yeah.
Nonetheless, 3 years is quick.
Mm.
3 years is quick because, you know, we're looking at Manchester United at the moment. They're in good form. They're in very, very good form. They're winning a lot of games. But if you watch the games, you're looking at it and thinking, God, blimey, they were hanging on a little bit against Luton, weren't they? And they were hanging on a little bit here and everything.
Which Eric Ten Hag has alluded to himself.
They're not, you know, it's not Arsenal winning 6-0 at West Ham and then 5-0 at Burnley. They're not those sort of performances.
Do you think, in a slight fairness to Ratcliffe, or at least to put the opposite side across, did he need to be this bullish? Did it kind of need a bit of this? You know, he's finally got the takeover ratified.
Well, no one said a Dickie Bird. No owner of Manchester United said a Dickie Bird about that football club in about 15 years.
Exactly. So did he need to come out politically?
Yeah. To have a fella come out and go, right, we're Manchester United and you know, and start talking as if you're Manchester United.
Mm.
Yeah, because to change the sort of the focus and the context of what the discussion has been about Manchester United, to say, we're shifting the focus back to the football side of this club.
Yeah.
It's not just a commercial entity. So this is positive in many ways. For Manchester United fans, I'm sure will feel that way. Yeah, there was the Fergie bingo. Yeah, the 3 years is possibly bullish and he might come to regret that. I thought he also strayed quite close to the line of, like, you know, he basically said it's been misery. He said it's been misery for the last 11 years. You wonder, like, what the Glazers feel about how close he came to the line of saying that they've been a disaster, really. And he said it without saying it.
Which he obviously can't do because he doesn't have a full control of the club.
Of course,
I'm sure
and
he probably
even said,
would. Yeah.
He even said, I think, in in further down in Matt Dickinson's piece, like, you know, I'm sure we won't have to go into the bottom drawer to pull out the legal agreements about what can and cannot be said. But he came close. Also, there were bits in it that jarred with me, like saying we're still debating what the style of play should be for this football club. I mean, I don't think you should be anywhere near the debate, Jim.
No. That's first. Absolutely not. That's the manager.
He did later down say, like, I'm not the football expert. So, you know, that was a bit contradictory. But, you know, and he was also pointing out that Manchester City have, 13 clubs, and the City Football Group have 13 clubs, of which Manchester City are one, and they all play in the same style. There's like a philosophy, a blueprint, and he was alluding to that we need to find what that is and decide what that is about Manchester United. Where Eric Ten Hag fits into all that, these are big questions. Mm. So, and he didn't come anywhere near to saying Eric Ten Hag is the man.
He's our man.
No,
yeah.
I mean, there was more of a future for Mason Greenwood at Manchester United.
Yeah, probably,
looking at
right,
the answers
yeah.
yesterday, there was more of, you know, a decision being made about Mason Greenwood than there was a decision being made about Eric Ten Hag yesterday, which I thought was very interesting.
I think the Ten Hag issue is potentially a really tricky one, because I think you're approaching a situation where, you know, I've said before that I think in general managers it takes time to build something really good. And, you know, there's so many examples of that throughout football history, and we sort of tend to forget it. And
well, Arsenal and Arteta
is exactly is the best recent example. But having said that, I still am really struggling to see just the kind of the underlying things that would give you real optimism that Ten Hag is the man. Just like, you know,
as in on the pitch.
On the pitch, yeah. Control of games, sort of a sense of kind of, you know, building and sort of establishing patterns of play. It still just feels like it's a little way off where you would probably have hoped that it would be when he was appointed. But you're also potentially, as Martin rightly said, the form has really picked up. They actually had a really, really good first season. It's certainly not impossible that they could finish, you know, it's really not impossible that they could finish, you know, fifth this season, and that might even be a Champions League place.
Yeah.
So you're in a position where the decision on Ten Hag is, I think, potentially a really difficult judgment call for the new, for Ratcliffe or, you know, whoever is in the position to make that call, because you're in a position where it might feel really harsh to move on. And, you know, actually, if, you know, let's say for argument's sake that they do finish fifth this season, you'd actually be looking at quite a solid body of work results wise over the first two seasons. But equally, it's still just, I don't know whether I believe that he's the right manager to take Manchester United forwards.
There doesn't seem to be the same love for Ten Hag from within Manchester United, say with the Ratcliffe group, so to speak. Liverpool have always been in love with Jurgen Klopp from the first scenes and onwards, same with Manchester City and Pep Guardiola. That press conference yesterday, you didn't get that same feeling of warmth. You didn't get the idea that you know, Jim Ratcliffe was thinking to himself, we've got absolutely the best man for this job. We could not be happier with our manager, which, you know, was Liverpool's attitude towards Jurgen Klopp. You know, was Manchester's attitude towards Pep Guardiola right from the very start. Moment Tottenham and Ange Postecoglou is the same, and you would imagine the same at Arsenal with Mikel Arteta. Everyone seems very, very happy with their manager at the moment. Villa and Unai Emery, Manchester United, almost as if there's someone there going, I think we might be able to do better.
There are a lot of slates being cleaned here too. I think it wouldn't be a surprise. Wouldn't be a surprise to change, because the most important thing that came out of this was his acceptance and the sort of acknowledgement that there have been a lot of capable managers, like successful managers, at this club in the last 11 years. The thing that we have sort of come to the realization of is that the environment in which they've been working hasn't been right. So it's up to me to fix that. But there's, as I say, there's a lot of slates being cleaned, and it might be that they clean the full lot and Erik ten Hag's days are numbered.
Can I throw a kind of wild card out there? If you're Manchester United...
And you've been really bullish.
Should you be looking at Thomas Tuchel, potentially? I mean, is that a name that comes into your...
Were you going to say Alonso?
I was, yeah.
I mean, maybe that too. I mean, I just sort of... I would sort of.
Well, they are being bullish, aren't they?
Absolutely. Yeah.
If you look at the appointments, they're poaching from Newcastle, they're poaching from Manchester
City. Sometimes it needs it. And, you know, Bobby Robson... When he took over England, I can't remember who the first match was against, but he takes over England and he's at his press conference and he's got his team. He's got the team for the following day written down on this piece of paper. And someone else, let's say it was Denmark, and someone said to him, "You got a message for Denmark, Bobby." And he threw the piece of paper down on the desk and he went, "This is my team and we're coming to get you." And it was like this... Fantastic. And then all the newspapers went on strike, by the way, that night. It never got published. That story
really?
Never got published because someone touched the hot metal or something like that, and my father-in-law called everyone out. And all the papers went on strike and nothing appeared. But that was what he said.
This is my team and we're coming to get you.
Now, you think, yeah, that's the way to start. You know, if you know, what a great start that is. And in many ways, that's what Jim Ratcliffe did yesterday. This is Manchester. We're Manchester United and we're coming to get you.
Mm.
And if you like competition, and I like competition, you know, in football more than anything, yeah, great. Okay, Manchester United, the fancy their chances. Fantastic. I don't like all the rules that stop everyone else fancying their chances, but... I like the idea of Manchester United fancying their chances and City fancying their chances, Liverpool fancying their chances and Tottenham wanting to play football and you know, Villa. That's great. That's absolutely a thriving, you know, watching Manchester United sixth and seventh. We can, you know, everyone's laughing up their sleeve at it a little bit, but it would be better if there was a vibrant Manchester United challenging everyone and playing the football that we remember them playing.
Yeah.
Which was... never taken a backward step. That's right. Growing up watching the game, what I loved about going to Upton Park and watching when Manchester United came to town, because even then, and they weren't very good always, they never took a backward step. You know, Liverpool, who were a genuinely, genuinely great team, would come down and bore you a submission, because they were going to win 2-0 and it's going to be very organised and the goal will be great and some of the forward play will be great, but they knew exactly what they were about and it was all Manchester United. You never knew what was going to happen.
Yeah, but you touched then on the Ferguson era and that brilliant team and how brilliant they were and wanting them to get back to that. But that is also, you alluded to earlier about the kind of can't get away from Alex Ferguson.
Well, yeah.
Also have that with Matt Lawton's exclusive story on the Times website about Jim Ratcliffe wanting Gary Neville to help Man United's stadium plan as well. It's these players and managers from this era, it feels like they, you know, you can't get away from them. Is that a good thing that they're involving these people and evoking these memories? Or should they be, as Gregor says, clean slating it completely?
Well, I suppose we're getting Gary involved. It's in that entrepreneurial way. He's got a very high public profile, and they probably want him inside the tent rather than outside the tent, to use an analogy. So
you think it's...
I think it's easier when clubs are successful to make these kind of calls and nobody bat an eyelid.
Yeah.
You know, Manchester City, you know, give ambassadorial roles to people like Micah Richards and no one bats an eyelid.
But ambassadorial roles different to actually saying to Gary Neville, you know, help me build a, you know. And he has, like in that area, he owns the Hotel Football, which is just opposite the road from Old Trafford. But at the same time, he's not... I mean, I don't think he's an architect, as far as I know. He's a very successful man who's worked incredibly hard. But anyway, sorry, I was just...
No, I'm just saying, I think it's easier to be critical of these things when you're... Look, they're trying to get good PR. They're also at a low ebb.
Mm. They want friends.
It's easier to say you need to leave those days behind, but...
Yeah.
They want friends. They particularly want friends with that stadium project because, you know, one of the first... problems they encountered. Oh, Wembley of the North, and we're going to, you know, we want it, you know, we'll ask for Levelling Up money, ask for Northern Powerhouse money or whatever. And as a number of people have pointed out, the bloke who's asking for that money is a tax exile living in Monaco. So they've got a sort of image problem with that straight away. Basically, aren't Manchester United based in the Cayman Islands?
Good question. I don't know the bloody answer.
I think they are.
In 2 minutes, producer Neil will call me here and tell me whether they are.
Confirm
or
deny. I think Manchester United are based in the Cayman Islands. The Glazers and a bloke who lives in Monaco. Now,
plus, we're talking about.
I mean, look, anyone can own a football club. I don't care less about that. But if you're asking for government money, it would help if someone was playing to the extent.
Or there hadn't been chronic underinvestment for the last decade by the guys who own it.
Absolutely. Yes.
Manchester United PLC, based in the Cayman Islands. Thank you producer Neil.
So,
well done.
Yeah, so this is what I mean. There's going to be an image problem if they're asking for government money or whatever. So Gary Neville, who most certainly does pay his taxes in this country, is not the worst guy to be the face of the redevelopment of Old Trafford.
Talking about the other people bringing in, James, what have you made of both the successful hiring of Omar Berada, stealing him from Manchester City in terms of being bullish, and now the pursuit of Dan Ashworth as a sporting director, in terms of Ratcliffe making statements that say, we are going to modernise this club?
Yeah, I think, I mean, I don't have like strong opinions on it, but I think in general, the club probably has needed a more kind of coherent, modern football structure. You know, Dan Ashworth, obviously, his career has had good bits and bad bits, but I think, you know, generally he seems to be a really, you know, competent sporting director. So, I don't have a problem
But it's just incredible. I'll say it again. It's just incredible that this is only just happening.
Mm.
This is only just happening. This is not this whole structure has been non-existent or has consisted of people who've just been hanging around the building for years and have been promoted into roles that they've never done before, have no knowledge of football. It's extraordinary that it's taken 11 years for Manchester United to have anything resembling a modern football structure that any other successful football club in Europe has.
In terms of Ashworth, Martin, Ratcliffe comments about being on gardening leave and what a shame it would be for a talented man to be out doing the weeds is a simple solution.
There
to
is
solving,
a very simple solution, Jim. It's called, you know, writing a cheque for the current estimate is £20 million. You know, the figure I put on it was £60 million. It was more of a bit of fun than anything that you were going to get. But I'd still think 20 million. I'd ask for 30 if I was Newcastle. See, look, what has happened is, if you make everything about money, right, which everything is now about money, everything. If you buy that cup of coffee, you've got to put it in some column or it comes out of this column or into that column. Right, so £30 million out of Manchester United's kitty goes into that little red column there, and £30 million goes into your black column there. And that's what they've made football about. Mm. So I don't see why everyone seems surprised or horrified when Newcastle are supposedly asking Manchester United for what is considered an astronomical compensation for an executive. And people say, oh, yeah, but Newcastle just took someone off Brighton. Yes, they did. But Newcastle aren't very, very actively pursuing all of the rules and regulations that a club like Manchester United want to put in place for everybody else. So you can't have it that it's all got to be about money and then not imagine that there is a consequence to that, which is that if you're going to make it about money, well, then let's make it about money, lads. You give us £30 million, that goes into our, you know, so we're now £60 million apart on the profit and sustainability. Right, that seems a reasonable way of doing it. It's just
you should have been the accountant, not WD-40.
No,
I can't believe I didn't see that coming.
It should have been your nickname.
Bloody WD-40. I rushed it. Damn it.
No, this is the thing. I don't want to be the accountant. I don't think it should be about accountancy. I think it should be about the best of this club against the best of that club with no one sitting there going, this is the problem. They've made football about accountancy. I don't want to watch accountancy.
Fine.
I've got an accountant. I don't want to watch him work.
But look, thinking about, come bring it back to the pitch, let's finish with Manchester United on the pitch. Because James, kind of, you touched on it, talking about this team that Ten Hag has got, the potential there. And, you know, I've discussed it with Paul Hurst. When you look at that team and you think Hoyland scored, is scoring now absolutely. And looking really good. We talked about it on Monday. Rashford one side, Garnacho the other side. That's quite a kind of a front three that you could A, get excited by, and B, see a real kind of growth and potential. On the pitch, do we think they're lacking lots, or is there actually, now they've got a lot of players back, and obviously Luke Shaw's injury looks like it might rule him out for the rest of the season, which is a massive blow, but on the pitch, do they actually look like they've got the germs of a good team potentially, James?
I think in terms of individuals, I think they're part of the way there, but not there yet, really.
That's a no.
That's a no. Gregor Robertson no.
I think you know, as you say, they have potentially an exciting forward line. Obviously, you know, Minor has come in and looked really good. Looked like he could be a piece of a really good team that you're building.
In terms of that forward line, I just realised you mentioned Mason Greenwood earlier, Martin. Mm. But what did we make of those kind of suggestions, or is it all about money?
Two things, yeah. There you go.
I teed you
two
up.
Things. Two things. One, you don't know if they would entertain having him back, or whether that would be regarded as too disruptive or whatever. But two, if they aren't going to have him back, then they'll sell him.
Hmm.
Now, everyone thought they should just cancel the contract. Yeah. And this.
Which also wasn't necessarily how it was framed at the time. The
no,
suggestion
it wasn't.
The
they,
time.
They left a door open, but again, we're back to, if you make everything about money, then if you're Jim Ratcliffe and you've got to pretend Manchester United are poor because of FFP, then, right, how do we get money in? Well, that's pure profit, because he's a kid through your... This is the great irony, that the thing that everyone thinks is most marvellous about Manchester United, which is this youth policy that has sustained them in many ways through decades and, you know, through much more than half a century. They're the guys that the rules now say, yeah, smart move with Marcus Rashford. If you can get PSG to pay £100 million for him, that's £100 million, like, pure profit. We're all raving about Mainoo. People are talking about, could he be in an England squad? He is this gem that Manchester United have produced, but the smartest thing you could do is sell him.
Hmm.
In terms of your budget.
Yeah.
You know, sell him.
You're
know,
not actually we, saying the smart
no,
thing
No, I'm not
to
saying it's a smart thing.
No,
it's
but
not.
You're saying
but
from
what
the
I'm
money
saying
point
is that from a financial point of view, his rules are basically saying, sell your kids. You know, sell the crown jewels. If you produce someone, you know, Mason Mount.
Although, in fairness, you know, they're only saying that if you've overspent.
No, they're saying it because to allow you to spend.
Yeah, but they've spent really badly in the last
decade.
They've
spent really badly. So, but then again, they're Manchester United.
If Chelsea hadn't spent £1 billion in three transfer windows, they wouldn't have to sell all their kids. That's all I'm saying. Like, I understand that that is a flaw in the rules, but the clubs for whom it's a flaw are the clubs who spent money really badly.
Yeah, but you're allowed to spend money really badly. It's not an exact science, the transfer market, and it never has been. You're going to make a mistake.
Coming back to the team, I think they're miles off. I mean, we can hum and ha about it, but they're still relying on Johnny Evans to come on against Luton in the last game. Played really well, but like,
so three. Coming back to that 3 years thing, you're not confident of the 3 years, Gregor.
Well, come back to Martin's point, they probably will have to do some interesting accountancy work if they want to spend money on the team, because even anyone that they've spent money on is not worth anything like what the money they spent on them. Jadon Sancho, what would they get for him now if they were willing to sell him? You know, who knows, a new manager might welcome him back into the fold. Anthony, what would they get for him? I can't see anyone who's appreciated in value. I can't see anyone who's a major asset. Who's a major asset apart from Rashford? Hoyland, they're not going to sell, they just bought him. Who? Mm-hmm. Garnacho. Yeah, but
you don't want to say.
I mean, I suppose the
other
one
is the best players. Yeah.
There's no one else that's an asset, so it's going to be an issue for them.
One of the other issues from a United sort of, you know, kind of from a sort of future oriented point of view, you know, sort of building towards, you know, potentially having a title winning team in 3 years. their best player is Bruno Fernandes, in my opinion. And Bruno Fernandes is, what, 30 years old?
Mm.
So is he part of that, you know, team that's going to win you the title in 3 years? Again, that's another difficult decision, you know.
The thing that I've taken Arsenal, we think, have taken Arsenal another step this season, is a bit more strength and depth. It takes time to even do that. So to get your team into a position where...
Your squad. Your
best 11 into a position where you're able to challenge Man City and Liverpool and now Arsenal, that will take time. But to have the strength and depth that it takes to compete on all fronts, and to have a backup that's not got Johnny Evans on it on the bench, that's, you know,
and people won't want to leave.
Yeah,
and people won't want to leave. If you remember last summer, with a lot less positive, it was it was a good first season. They won a trophy and they qualified for the Champions League. They couldn't get Scott McTominay out of the club. Harry Maguire had a chance to go, didn't want to go. Why is this summer going to be any different if Jim Ratcliffe is about to usher in this title-winning era, this next 3 years, here we go, you know, this time next year, Rodgers will be millionaires or whatever. if he's about to usher that in, why would Harry Maguire want to go this summer? Why would Scott McTominay want to go this summer? You'd say, no, I want to be part of this. I've sat through a lot of rubbish here, you know. Now the good times are coming. I want to be part of that. It will be quite hard to get people off the books this summer. You know, unless you're literally going to say to somebody, we are not even going to register you for our Premier League squad or our Champions League squad or wherever they are this next season. We're not even going to register you. So if you want to play football, you're better off leaving. We're 2 years away from the World Cup. So there's not an immediate pressure. Oh, there's an international tournament at the end of the season. Like, you know, the Calvin Phillips thing, where in the end Calvin Phillips went to West Ham because he was worried about his international place. You haven't even got that pressure. It's not quite as easy as it might look.
It will be a fascinating journey, I'm sure, and we'll be here judging them all the way. Manchester United fans, or any other fans, if you've got views on Jim Ratcliffe or anything else that you want us to talk about, you can get in touch with me, tom.clark@thetimes.co.uk. But for now, James Gearbrand, Martin Samuel, or should I say the accountant, and Gregor Robertson, thank you very much for joining me. Keep your ears out for that special episode with Alison Rudd that we've got coming up, but the rest of us will be back on Monday to talk about a thrilling Carabao Cup final.
As you're listening to me, Daisy, Apple's iPhone disassembly robot, is dismantling an iPhone into lots of recyclable parts. That's how Apple recovers more materials than conventional recycling methods. Thanks, Daisy. There's more to iPhone.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.